Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The 90s was a time of tremendous turmoil and excitement in Mexico. The economic promise of NAFTA, the masked face of Subcomandante Marcos, and the last gasp of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. Well, it all led to dramatic change, the election of President Vicente Fox and the idea of a new Mexico. It's been a time of great literary ferment as well. A gang of under 30 writers calling themselves the Crack Movement stood up to take their place, to step out of the shadow of the older, better-known writers of Latin America, people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez or Carlos Fuentes. It is for the young writers, like Ignacio Padilla, a redefinition of identity, looking to tackle subjects perhaps more original than aboriginal. Which explains why Padilla's latest book is set in Austria and Britain and Germany, not in Mexico. And they are desperate to prove that magical realism is not Mexico. Connection listeners, we're continuing our series on the writers of changing and emerging nations. How important is it for a writer to write about his or her country, to define national identity by way of fiction? And are the rules or expectations different for Mexican writers than they would be, for example, for Americans or the Brits? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, the writer Ignacio Padilla. His first book to be translated into English will be released in the United States shortly. It's called Shadow Without a Name. It happens that Mr. Padilla is also cultural attaché for the Mexican Embassy in London, and he joins us from London today. Hello, Mr. Padilla.
Over there in Boston.
I understand that aside from being a novelist, this job of yours, this cultural attaché job, is to sell Mexican culture outside Mexico.
Well, yes, in a way. I always consider myself an accidental diplomat and part of an experiment of Mexican new government having sending Mexican writers to work as cultural attachés in Europe, mostly.
How does it get in the way of your work as a writer?
Terribly. I think that this experience doesn't fit very well with writing. There's a lot of work to do. But fortunately, Mexican culture and art are very easy to promote. But on the other hand, it's a very difficult thing to do in London, particularly since there are so many other options from so many other countries being promoted as well.
Now, let's go back to the beginning of the crack movement. How did that begin?
Well, it began mostly as a joke, as a game. We never expected this literary group to become a movement or a generation. We are very happy that eventually it did. But we thought when we were very young, we met a couple of young writers or adolescent writers in high school. And we wrote together and we decided one day that we were quite tired of the imitators or the perversions of the great literary masters of the literary boom. And so we decided to make this playful manifesto, trying to call everybody to go back to the example of García Márquez, Carlos Fuentes, Vargas Llosa, Cortázar, and Borges, and to forget all this idea about magic realism and this very light literature, trying to grow our iguanas to make them look like dinosaurs.
Now, when you put this manifesto out there, it wasn't received very well back in, what, in 96?
96, yes, and it was terrible. There was a reaction, mostly by those who think that literature, Mexican literature, must be about Mexico. And we are very keen to write about Mexico, but also to write about many other places and many other things. And we were very young. The manifesto probably was full of contradictions. But in the end, eventually also, I think that things turn out in a different way.
Let's turn to an example of that. Do you have a copy of the Shadow Without a Name there
in
the studio with you?
Yes.
I wonder if I could get you to just read the first few paragraphs under the title of Franz Kretschmar. Is that correct?
Yes, that's one of the four voices that speak in the novel.
Okay, this is the voice of Ignacio Padilla reading from Shadow Without a Name.
My father used to say his name was Viktor Kretschmer. He was a pointsman on the Munich-Salzburg line and not the type to decide, on the spur of the moment, to commit a crime. His apparent rashness in adversity concealed an extremely calculating mind, an ability to wait years for the right circumstances to hit a long-cherished target. So, while apparently taciturn, he was privately given to unforeseeable outbursts of rage, which made him a time bomb on a short fuse. These were not spontaneous impulses, but the product of that endless soliloquy he pursued with his defeated self, as one who, I'm sure, could have drilled a tunnel through basalt rock, driven by the hope of one day recovering the light which was snatched from him in his youth. I once saw him hide for more than 10 hours, awaiting the reappearance of a famished hare which had dodged his first shots of the day. It was night time before the animal finally surrendered to its executioner, finished off with a flurry of kicks, which soon reduced it to an inedible lump of blood and snow. Years later, while my father half-heartedly denied the railway tribunal's accusations, I asked my mother if she remembered that story of the hare, but she could not or would not answer me. Since the accident, she had locked herself into an impenetrable silence in solidarity, I thought at first, with the family's disgrace. Later, however, when she heard the judge's verdict, my mother sighed deeply, dropped her head, and let out a wail of relief, freed at last of a burden that had poisoned every second of her existence. My words of consolation, offered from the depth of my own confusion, barely calmed her. Then, as if making an indirect reply to my question about the hare, she pointed at my father and muttered, "That man, my son, is called Thaddeus Dreyer, and he despises trains from the bottom of his heart."
That's Ignacio Padilla reading from the beginning of his book, which is soon to be released in the United States under the title Shadow Without a Name. Now, we've got now, in the first page, two names for the man, Thaddeus Dreyer and Viktor Kretschmar, and an exchange of identities that goes on through the book. But, Ignacio, where's the Mexican in this?
Well, the Mexican is the universal Mexican. I think that we can still be Mexicans and still try to talk about those places we're interested in. I am sure that today, particularly, everything happening in Austria or Japan or Africa has to do with Mexico. So I am Mexican, but I can say with many other writers that my nation is my language, mostly. And I write in Spanish, and I think that's the real nation, but also I'm a citizen of the world, and every writer, I think, or I hope, if he wants to take himself seriously, would have to think that way.
Is this something that people in Mexico are raising their eyebrows about, saying, "Oh, no, you with the talent, you have to write about our country, you have to explain our country to the rest of the world"?
Well, you know, it used to be that way, but after 6 or 7 years of so many new writers trying to express themselves, still in Spanish, but about many other places in the world, I think that things are changing a lot in Mexico, not only in politics, but also in literature. And the good thing is that also the masters of the boom have been quite supportive of this reaction. They made an excellent work explaining to the world what Latin America and what Mexico is. So why should we try to do it better than they did? They've done it already, and they've done it excellently.
I need you to be a little more specific for me, because you stand very proudly on the shoulders of those great masters of the boom. So what is it that you're rejecting? What is it that you want to move past if it's not the boom?
We got the feeling that after the great success of the literary boom of these wonderful writers, there came a couple of generations, not only one, but I'd say two generations of writers, novelists particularly, who just picked up these very, very easy to sell images of banana republics with extreme situations, with ghosts and flying people and all that, just imitating García Márquez. but for example, 100 Years of Solitude, it's not the story about ghosts or flying people. It's the Bible. It's the history of the world from Adam and Eve to the apocalypse. So I think that that was lost in the literature of their imitators. And also Latin America changed a lot after that. So we're now an urban, cosmopolitan, more international subcontinent, if you want. So I think that we thought that it was the moment to let people know that everything's changed a lot, and that we're not a jungle with flying ghosts all around, as some literature wanted the world to believe.
Now, part of what came after the boom writers was thought to be perhaps the most marketable part, the idea that Mexico could be sold as the land of magic realism, and that films and lesser novels then started to take advantage of that.
Yes, it's true. And I think for tourism, it was wonderful, but not for the arts. I personally think that a film like Water for Chocolate was a light, interesting, and amusing film. But I don't think it will have a deep effect on the arts. And I don't think it will prevail as a film in terms in aesthetic or artistic terms for a very long time. I rather think that a film like Amores Perros, I don't know the title in America, but it should be something like Love Savage or something. I think that's a more serious attempt, a more ambitious attempt, not to sell Mexico, but just to make real art.
Let me ask you, as one of the founders of the crack movement, if part of the whole exercise is to choose your locations and your characters that are in Germany and Austria and Britain as opposed to in Mexico, what do we see in the writing that distinguishes that from the writing of someone who lives in Singapore or the writing of someone who lives in Canada?
I don't think there should be any different. Every writer is an individual, and I must say that we haven't renounced to the Mexican setting or scenery. We just feel that if the story needs to be told somewhere else, and it can be told in a better way if it takes place somewhere else, we just feel free and defend our right to do so. I wanted to write a novel about trains and chess, and there are no trains in Mexico, and no one plays chess. So I had to write that somewhere else, and I feel quite confident that Austria was the place to write about that.
And it won the main Spanish writing award, did it not? The Premio. I'm just looking for that on my notes, and I forget it.
Yeah, but it's called Primavera as well. It's not the well, very difficult to say which award is the most important, but it was. I think it was a very good prize, and it was a good recognition, not to my novel, but to the generation itself. That same year or a year before, there were like there was this new boom of young Latin American writers now being recognized in Spain, who were not writing the typically Latin American literature. And that was the beginning of something that came out nicely.
Connection listeners, my guest is Ignacio Padilla, one of the hot new writers from Mexico, part of the crack movement. We were also talking about the boom, the great Latin American literary movement that preceded theirs. And we are going to talk with one of the catalysts of the boom, Carlos Fuentes, when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to our ongoing literary series examining the changing writing and changing nations. We'd like to hear from you. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, our number 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the literature, the changing literature of Mexico. Joining us from a studio at the BBC in London, Ignacio Padilla. His book, Shadow Without a Name, is going to be released in the United States early next year. We're talking about that as an example of the new writing you've heard us mention a couple of times through the program, the name of Carlos Fuentes. He is the author of some 20 novels. He also was a former ambassador. I have to ask him about that. And is considered one of the primary writers of what's called the Latin American boom. He joins us on the phone from London. Mr. Fuentes, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Dick. Very nice.
Now, you've had a chance to listen to Mr. Pitt. Well, you two know each other, but
we know each other. We're talking on this program about 10 blocks apart, you know.
So open the window.
So let's just open the window and let the rain in.
Better not let the rain in. The BBC would never forgive us. We're talking about a change from the boom to the crack movement. In your view, as one of the principles of the boom, is the change due now? Is this the right time to move on?
Absolutely. You know, there is no creation without tradition, and there is no tradition without new creation. So there has been a course of the Latin American novel throughout the 20th century. Let's say you had the granddaddies, Borges and Carpentier, Les Amalima, Onetti, then the daddies of the boom, who have been mentioned in the program, then what I called the boomerang, which were these generations that came after us with a great abundance of female writers. That was more or less the novelty. And now this splendid generation that calls itself the crack, with my friend Ignacio Padilla, my friend Eloy Urroz, my friend Jorge Volpi, my friend Pedro Palou, and an extraordinary woman also called Cristina Rivera Garza. So already when you can mention five top-flight writers in one breath, it means the movement has consistency and it's here to stay.
And is a part, an important part of that in your mind, that it's time writers stopped writing about Mexico?
No, in the sense that you could blame Graham Greene for writing about religious persecution in Mexico. Or about consuls who get drunk in Cuernavaca against Malcolm Lowry, or having D.H. Lawrence write about Mexico and say how much he hates bullfights. They did not cease to be English writers.
Right.
Or maybe that was not the point at all, that they were writing novels that dealt with Mexico, which were Mexican novels written by British authors, but finally what they were novels. And they remained and are accepted as works of art. They are not defined by the nationality of their writers or their locale.
Ignacio Padilla, can I put you back to work? I wonder if you could read once again from the Shadow Without a Name.
Sure.
This is about page 80, and I think that, maybe you should just tell us a little bit about what's going on and then just go straight into the reading.
Well, this is one of the very frequent and multiple impersonations taking place. This is taking place in the First World War in the trenches of the Balkans, and there's this meeting of a Catholic to be priest and a Jewish impersonator who are in this chaotic hellish place and getting to re-meet and know each other before one of them actually dies.
Go ahead.
I have been everyone and no one, he said with the sorrow of repentance. I have stolen so many names and so many lives that even you couldn't count them. The last one belonged to a poor recruit from Vorarlberg called Thaddeus Dreyer. I traded my death for the name of Victor Kretschmer and the miserable future as a pointsman. So you see, Father, how little this soul you are so intent on saving is worth by now. Despite these words and Efrusi's obvious desire to die, I tried to dissuade him, saying that from then on he wouldn't have to steal lives, for we would both go back to Austria together, where we would forget all about the war. He thanked me with a smile intended to be warm, despite the renewed trembling under his beard. His resistance to returning would be difficult to surmount, and I started to realize his motives for being there. Efrusi was not mad. Rather, he was thinking with the crushing logic of the defeated, with the final resignation of a man who had been forced continually to flee an identity which had always seemed to him too onerous and confining to endure. In some way, in the past, we both wanted to escape our condition, our race, and the faith of our fathers, and now was the time to confront the futility of that flight.
Ignacio Padilla, reading from Shadow Without a Name. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation about the changing nature of Mexican literature. Carlos Fuentes, I'm going to put you to work as a professor here.
Come on.
And do a book report for me on Shadow Without a Name. The whole idea that identity can be something that's so easily switched and traded.
Well, I think this is one of the great traditions of literature. I said a moment ago that literature lives through new creation because it is nourished by former traditions. So the question of identity, which Ignacio Padilla poses, is a timeless subject. Probably Homer inaugurated it. You remember when Ulysses, on the way back, disguises himself as the man without a name, the man no one knows. This disguising yourself, changing your identity, is one of the great, great traditions of literature. I think of the Count of Monte Cristo, to give you an example. Mm-hmm. Huh? So I think Padilla is in that great tradition. And I would even say, and I hope Ignacio takes this seriously, and that it helps to sell the book, that an antecedent I find for this marvelous novel of his is nothing less than Eric Amber's Mask of Demetrios. In which you have a Central European setting and a changing identity, a changing character. You never know exactly who he is. He was Zachary Taylor in the film, which was a disaster. But the novel is a marvelous novel about changing, about the metamorphosis, the mutations of identity. So Padilla is in a great universal tradition when he's writing a book like Shadow Without a Name.
Ignacio.
Well, what can I say? Carlos Fuentes has not only he's not only a great writer, but always too generous, and particularly with us. I'm worthless.
No, you don't have to say that. The other way of looking at identity is, in many ways, it's exactly what links you both as writers. Because for as much as Terra Nostra and the death of Artemio Cruz help us with identity in terms of an understanding of the characters Fuentes presents us, your writing about identity also leads us in many ways the same direction.
Well, I'd say that, well, that's true. And what we learned, or we hope we're trying to learn from our great models and masters, is that there are many ways of trying to talk about identity, and that we are many things, and sometimes we're nobody. But we are Latin Americans. We live sometimes in Mexico City. We live in London. And we're always traveling and trying to know who we are. And we do that by reading and by writing and by reading each other as well. The same way I read Carlos Fuentes. So I read for Jorge Volpi, I intend to be read by someone else who can actually tell me who I am.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Catherine is on the line. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. I would like to say hello to Ignacio. I think the literature he's talking about and the crack movement is actually, I'm going to be really hard, nothing new. I think The Shadow has a name. It is the name of the literature of 2000. Being very universal, it's very good for the Mexican literature, but in a way, it's very sad. I mean, before there was a break with the crack literature, there was La Literatura Basura, which really made a big crack, I would say, and now we're going to something universal. I wouldn't use globalized because that's not the word, but it's a way of writing that we can, and we have seen already before. It makes me sad that we can't have, again, the very traditional Mexican literature. Of course, we have to go on with our time. And I'm still very young, so I wouldn't have to be paseísta, like they say in Spanish.
You're not coming at this from a nostalgic or romantic point of view, Catherine?
Being Argentine, part Argentine, yes, I could be very nostalgic. But I think, like, you cited Amores Perros. I think Amores Perros would be crack, really. Because it's still the traditional Mexican view, but written with a very, very young and hard spirit. Yes. The same as Tu Mama Tambien, yes. which I think still remains in that atmosphere
well,
of
I
Mexico.
Think, Yes, Catherine, I think you're right, and I don't think it's hard what you're saying. I understand why you say it. I think that the literatura basura...
basura which, means garbage, doesn't it?
Garbage, yes. And I think that's a very interesting literature, the same way with this dirty realism being written by the writers of the group Macondo. I think that we're all together in the same boat, and this boat is literature. And if you count or you just take a look to what's been written by the authors of The Crack, you'll find out that from probably 40 books or 45, 40 of them take place in Mexico City. Not in Mexico only, but Mexico City. So, and that doesn't mean that we intend to be only to talk about Mexico, or the fact that we've written a couple of novels taking place in Europe, it doesn't mean that we intend to write about Europe. We just want to feel free and to defend, I insist, the right to talk about everything. And I would love to write something about Argentina. I would love to have someone like Roberto Bolaño from Chile doing what he does, writing about Mexico. I learn a lot from him. So you will have, and people will have novels about Mexico, because we've been having novels about Mexico since the Spaniards came to Mexico. So and the Austrians will have novels about Austria written by Mexican writers, and I think that's wonderful. We will. Literature is quite a wide spectrum, and I think we will have a lot of literature for everybody.
Yeah, but you know, I think about the literature itself. I don't see exactly why the movement is pretending that it wasn't free. I mean, even Cervantes was free to write and use his style. He made a big gap and a new change in literature, Cervantes, and he was free to do. And I don't see why there is a point of start in this conversation that says that there was not really a freedom because of the other writers before, like Octavio Paz or Borges. Everybody is free in time with literature to start something new. There is no revolution behind this. You understand what I mean? I'm being not only about the fact that this doesn't have to happen in Mexico or something. Being hard on that point, I'm saying, where is that big revolution that we're talking about? Isn't it just a phase that already exists?
No, I don't think we're talking about the Great Revolution. We're talking about just progress in literature. And I am sure that Octavio Paz and Alfonso Reyes and later Carlos Fuentes and García Márquez were reacting against some limitations and some pressure. This criollismo movement, which was mentioned by Emir Rodríguez Monegal and so many people, saying, why is there so much pressure from the academy, from the critics, from the market, from the reader, to talk only about a certain place of the world? Why should we think that we have an obligation to write only about our immediate reality? That's the kind of limitation we're trying to break with. And these limitations have been all the time there, and writers have been all the time trying to break with it. So I don't think we're talking about a great revolution, not at all.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Carlos Fuentes, the idea that writers are always free to write about what they want to, and maybe these notions of movements are a bit artificial.
No, in Mexico, you know, at least we had a long fight around this subject. The Mexican Revolution was the great watershed of Mexican modern history, and it liberated an enormous quantity of forces in all the realms of the arts, amongst them literature. And you have the novel of the Mexican Revolution and great novels with very Mexican themes like Martin Luis Guzmán, Agustín Yáñez, Juan Rulfo. But the flip side of this healthy, let's call it nationalism, was a sick nationalism, which said in order to be Mexican, we have to isolate ourselves from the world and have nothing to do with the rest of the world. I remember a literary critic in the 1950s saying, he who reads Proust prostitutes himself. I mean, it went as long as that. It was what José Luis Cuevas called the cactus curtain. It was an isolation from the world, and there were the people who fought against this isolation, very notably Alfonso Reyes in the 1930s, Octavio Paz in the 1950s, and so on. Now, what has changed, Dick, what has changed is that the fight for identity has been won. I think that no Mexican doubts what it means to be a Mexican. No Argentinian doubt what it means to be an Argentinian or a Chilean, a Brazilian. We have acquired an identity through trial and error, going through all these battles and discussions that we have been talking about. You know what we're really talking about, Dick, is that from the sense of ourselves, we now have to go to diversity. We have to go to the diversity of the societies and of its manifestations. You cannot have a single idea of Mexico or Argentina or Brazil. You now face the challenge of diversity. And it's not only a literary challenge. It's a sexual challenge. And it's a religious challenge. And it's a political challenge. It's a challenge in all orders of life. And I'm very happy to see that we are participating as writers in the process of going from identification to diversification, which is closely allied, let me add, to the sense of social diversity and to the practice of democracy.
Ignacio Padilla, if the cactus curtain has been trampled down, as Carlos Fuentes says, does that mean that your battles, your fights as an author will be those of, as he's describing, identity and writing about social change?
Not only social change. We've got so many things to talk about. I'd rather say let's talk about medical change, human change, everything. I mean, after September 11, we've got lots of things to write about, lots of things to think about. We've got to try to explain to ourselves to explain phenomena like Big Brother all around the world. That's what we've got to ask ourselves, and probably that's something we've got to write about. There are so many things taking place at the same time in many similar ways everywhere in the world. So I think there are lots of questions, not only social change. As Carlos Fuentes said, democracy, not only in Mexico, but in Latin America and in the former Soviet Union. I think that there are lots of things to write about.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, there are, as Ignacio points out, so many things to write about. What is it that you want to read about? Because in many ways, readers in the United States are an important audience for writers all over the world. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 for a conversation we're having about the changing nature of literature from Mexican writers. With me on the program, Ignacio Padilla. He's actually written about 10 novels, but the first one to appear in English translation in the United States will be out early next year. The name of the book is Shadow Without a Name, and I don't actually have time on the program to go through the list of Carlos Fuentes novels that have been translated into English and made available. You'll certainly know The Death of Artemio Cruz, Terra Nostra, The Old Gringo, and most recently Inez. I need to get both of you to help me with an understanding of not only who's writing, but who you're writing for, whether or not the audience is in fact meant to be in large part an audience that reads the work in translation, or whether or not the audience is principally reading the work in its original Spanish. Ignacio, perhaps you can begin on that.
Well, I think that's a very difficult question. The only answer I usually have to that is that I write for a ghost audience, an imagined audience who would be a bit of myself and a bit of all the people I can think of. It's very difficult and also very exciting to write for someone you don't know. And I don't think of a specific audience for my novels. I know that they're mostly written and thought in Spanish, but I think that the intention of the writer doesn't matter. I think that the most important thing is what is called intentionality of the book itself. So for me, the experience with Shadow Without a Name is that it's go far beyond of what I expected to be, of those places where I expected to be read, or of those languages I expected it to be read. So it's very exciting, and the best thing to do is not to think about that too much, I think.
Carlos, you're laughing.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm agreeing with Ignacio in the sense that you not only write for a ghost, that I think that books are written by ghosts as well. That there's a ghost inside you who works feverishly in your subconscious at night, and there he is when you wake up. You know, I think all writers have had that experience in which you have a perfectly formed plan for the day's work, and suddenly, whoom, the text goes somewhere you never thought of. Who is the ghost now that is writing that novel? A novel is, I think, like a manuscript inside a bottle which you throw into the sea and hope for luck that it won't sink. When you think that Standalone sold about 90 copies of Red and Black while he was alive, and did not become a huge universally recognized writer until the late 1920s. Were other writers? Do you remember Anthony Adverse by Hervey Allen? It was the big bestseller of 1935, the same year, I think, that Absalom came out. I don't think anybody reads Anthony Adverse today. We're all certainly reading Absalom all around the world.
So when we talk about the people who have been sort of at the front of the boom and the crack, I notice that as I look at the little list that I've drawn up here, that there are many more men on this list than there are women on the list. In fact, when the crack movement, Ignacio, kind of wants to elbow aside the boomerang, I think Carlos referred to them as the writers of Like Water for Chocolate, you're elbowing aside the women. What's going on with who's doing the writing in Mexico?
Well, I think that everybody's doing the writing in Mexico, and it's I think it's a mere accident, or I obviously it looks as if we were very politically incorrect, but I think that kind of suspicion comes from the people who make actually lists and try to think about representation also in literary groups or in literary generations.
Yeah.
I think there are wonderful writers, both male and female, in every single generation, and it's mainly, I think it's an impression. I don't think that the previous generation we talk about is mostly women. It's not only that it's women who are better known than male writers, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't make them better or worse.
Carlos?
You know, I'd like to add that in this new generation, I'm really very, very admiring of a young woman novelist called Cristina Rivera Garza, whom Ignacio knows well, and who's a very young woman born in, like Ignacio and Jorge Volpi, in the mid-1960s or late 1960s. And I really recommend a novel called Nadie Me Verá Llorar, No One Shall See Me Cry, which is a novel, an extraordinary novel, which takes place basically in a whorehouse and in a madhouse.
Now, are these two novels that you've just mentioned, Carlos, are they available in English?
I don't think so. They're not even available in Spanish, because our system of distribution is so bad that most novels just die an early death.
What happened to the Barcelona connection?
No, that is only one connection. We used to have the Buenos Aires connection in the 1940s and 50s. From Argentina, every single book that appeared was sent, even to the remotest village in Bolivia. You sent four copies if necessary. Now it is being commercialized, and you have the Spanish publishers, of course, in Madrid and Barcelona, but sometimes they only publish Chilean writers in Chile or Peruvian writers in Peru. There is no longer the continental distribution system that existed in my own youth and that helped us immensely to become a generation that was well known throughout Latin America.
I would have thought, Ignacio, that it would be much easier to be translated and to be distributed around the world at this point.
No, it's terribly difficult. Mostly in Latin America, there's a huge crisis of readers. For me, the same way Carlos is mentioning the Buenos Aires connection, we do need it and still need the Barcelona connection for one simple reason. Literature is made mostly, well, exists because of the audience, and readers are now, and the industry is now, in Spain, rather in Latin America. The only way I could get my novels read in Guatemala or in Belize was by publishing them in Spain. It's a pity in some way, but in the end, as we insist and say that our nation is language, so it doesn't matter if it's Barcelona, Buenos Aires, or Mexico. Still, I think that it's a reality. Latin American writers, for the moment, are having to publish in Spain because that's the way things do get published and do get read.
I need you to explain this a little bit more, though. I mean, the Latin American world is enormous. Are you saying that there are not enough people who are reading literature like this in Latin America?
Yes, I mean that. I mean to say that. There are not many readers, although we are many people, many Spanish speakers. I think there is a huge and quite dangerous and problematic dramatic problem of readership and publishing in Latin America, at least in Mexico. I'm sure there's that probably in Argentina as well, and Colombia. There's pirate books, there are not many readers, there are problems of distribution already mentioned by Carlos Fuentes, and although we are for 100 million Spanish speakers, we cannot say that we are actual readers of literature in general.
Carlos Fuentes,
isn't it also the case in the United States that the shelf life of a book is very short?
There's a lot of competition for the shelf space. I'm not sure if that's an answer to the question.
It is, because most books are out of the shelves in 2 or 3 weeks unless they become bestsellers immediately.
I have to tell you something. In this literature series that we're doing, last week we had the South African writer Zeke Semda in, and he was describing that it was in many ways easier for the black writers of South Africa to get published and get distributed in the English-speaking, well, they were most of them writing in English, but get distributed outside South Africa before the death of apartheid, because there was this appetite in America, in Canada, in Western Europe to read the books of the voices of the oppressed, that once the black writers were simply trying to describe an ordinary life, that their voice was competing or was not meeting the expectations that readers had.
That's right. You know, Juan Gutisolo, a Spanish writer, said when Franco died, he said, we wrote better while Franco was alive. We wrote better against Franco. And imagine all the Soviet writers that became world famous because they opposed the regime. Now you hardly hear about Russian writing anymore.
Now, Ignacio, you and I were quite young when Carlos Fuentes was stamping his foot at the Kennedy administration because they refused to give him a visa to come and speak in the early 1960s. But when that kind of outrage is taken away from the writer, Ignacio, does that create a bigger challenge for you?
Well, I think it's been said that our generation is a generation without ideals and quite skeptical, as opposed to Carlos Fuentes' generation. I was born in 1968, after Prague's 1968, after Mexico's Tlatelolco 68. So it's been said that we don't have ideals and we are not politicized and we are mostly skeptical. I think we are learning. We are learning that we are getting more involved and engaged in many different things, probably later than Carlos Fuentes' generation. We didn't have the Cuban Revolution. We didn't have so many things they did have, but we need them. We need them to write about them. We need to believe in something, and we need to make people believe in something. And I think that for the moment we are trying to find something to be engaged with and to believe in.
Carlos Fuentes, are we in a moment of transition, a little bit of confusion then, perhaps?
What?
Are we at a moment of confusion or transition?
Yes,
then?
Of course we are, because I was saying our voices overlap, that George Bush is certainly giving us a lot of ammunition now. But the fact is that we have gone from a bipolar world to a unipolar world, which is a countersense. And we have to create some kind of international order, or else we can have the United States simply bossing people around and doing whatever it pleases. And that cannot be. That would end in disaster. We have to create some kind of international order, a counterpole or a counterpower to the one power that now exists, the United States.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Ignacio Padilla, you said at the beginning of the program that it was less important that I or anyone else regard you as a Mexican writer, and much more important that I regard you as a writer. One of the other things that's happening at this moment, of course, is that the writers based in countries that are you know, more of more nations of immigrants. I'm thinking of Rohinton Mystery in Canada, V.S. Naipaul, perhaps an older example. But these are people who are of one part of the world and living in another part of the world and writing about anything that they want in many cases.
Yes.
Is that going to make a difference? Is that going to open things up?
Well, I think that we must remember what Catherine, who called a while ago, said. Cervantes himself wrote about many places. Although El Quijote takes place in Spain, he wrote about Italy and about Scandinavia, about Ireland and Britain, well, England. Mm-hmm. I think that's not new. I don't want to be read because I'm Mexican. I don't want to be read because I'm a male Mexican writer. I want to be read because people are interested in what I want to say. So I think that it can be a problem of people thinking about what the circumstances or the context of the writer is before they read the book. I think that could probably that could be a problem.
Maybe we need to take the nationalities and the names off the book cover, Carlos.
No. People, after all, you can write great universal novels from your roots. I think that probably the greatest Mexican novel of all times is Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo. And it could not be more Mexican in locale and subject matter. What makes it universal is the profoundly moving way that Rulfo deals with life and death, the beauty of the prose, the profundity of the thinking. That's what makes it universal, not the fact that it happens in Mexico.
And I would say the same about the same things about Carlos Fuentes' novels. They are really very Mexican, and I think that are also one, some of the most universal books we have. So and no one can deny that they are really Mexican. Probably our literature, the crack generation, people might think they don't look very Mexican. They are, because we are Mexican.
Of course.
Quick last question to both of you. Have you driven a stake into magical realism?
May I answer that,
sure.
Since it comes from my generation? magical realism belongs to only one writer. His name is Gabriel García Márquez. It is absolutely erroneous when suddenly I, myself, or Vargas Llosa, or Julio Cortázar are all lumped together into magical realism. That simply is not true. The inventor of magical realism was the great Cuban writer Alejo Carpentier. His inheritor was Gabriel García Márquez, and you cannot go beyond that. It belongs to them. And all the rest of us write in very different styles that have nothing to do with magical realism.
Ignacio, I think you got your question answered for you by the boss, huh?
Perfectly. That's the way it should be.
Ignacio Padilla, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Ignacio Padilla, author of the novel Shadow Without a Name. It's going to be released in the United States this coming April. Carlos Fuentes, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Tell Nacho to give me a ring.
All right, I'll do that. Publishing novels for 40 years, Mr. Fuentes has been, including The Death of Artemio Cruz, Terra Nostra, most recently Inez. Special thanks today to Ilan Stavins at Amherst College. Tune in next Thursday. We look at Russia on our literature.
This is